Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, we're going way out west. We're going to Hawaii. Yeah, paradise, where the weather's always wonderful. You'd think it would be. Don Mussel is our guest. He's an engineer on Kauai, and he travels the Hawaiian Islands building and fixing radio stations. That's next on This Week in Radio Tech.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By the Ruby console from Lavo. See Lavo and your future at lavo.com/twert. And by Angry Audio. Audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com.
Hey, everyone. Welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. It's a show where we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower and all the stuff in between. And oh, my goodness, today we're going to have a lot of fun. I cannot wait for our guest to come on and start doing a little show and tell with you. I'm Kirk Harnack. I work for the folks at the Telos Alliance. And today I'm not in our usual Telos Alliance studios in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm actually at the Telos Alliance in Cleveland, Ohio, where the weather has been just awful for several days in a row, and it's not so bad today, but it's just been really crummy, and that's one reason why I'm so happy to be doing this show, because we're going to jet off across the Pacific Ocean to the Hawaiian Islands with our guests. So you hang on. That's coming up. Right now, I want to bring in Chris Tobin, my co-host. Chris, you're in a comfortable-looking spot. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Yes, quite comfortable in our performance space here at the radio station, just having a cup of joe. It's pretty good.
Aha. Uh-huh. You got coffee. I'm stuck with some water, so oh well.
Well, I don't know. We have craft services here that – no, we don't. I'm only kidding. But, I have to get it myself. Don't they have craft services at Telos? Come on now.
Well, actually, we've had dealer meetings here, and we have been well served with lots of carbohydrates and coffee.
So. Dealer meetings. Interesting.
Yeah. Telos our elite cartel. Dealers. Yes, exactly. more plans for world domination.
We did see some – love it.
We did see some pretty exciting stuff this week. I can't tell you about, but if you come to NAB, you'll see it. And
we'll take it to the back room and discuss it.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, so let's bring our guest in from the island of Kauai. I guess that's where he is, somewhere there. I don't know exactly where. I think I've driven by your house, Don. It's Don Mussel from Hawaii. Don, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech.
Well, hi there.
Glad you're here. Now, you're in what people call paradise, although your weather's been kind of crummy the last few days.
It's been awful, but yeah, and it's not very pleasant today. I'm looking out the window. It's blowing about 40 miles an hour, and it's wet and 65 degrees here.
Don, we're going to get into some beautiful pictures and stories about how you deal with studios and kind of more fun transmitter sites in Hawaii, because you've got some amazing places to go. But I don't think I met you in Kentucky, but you and I had some of the same customers or clients in Kentucky, right?
Yep, we did.
Yeah, it was. Some little town in southeast Kentucky, Whitesburg, I think it was.
Whitesburg was it? Letcher County.
That's right. I remember doing some work at a studio that was by the highway. It was just over the county line, just over the state line in Virginia, and it shows you what happens when you have a dry county. I'd sit in front of the radio station. I'd look up the road, and there was a beer store. And the beer store was 100 feet or so from the state line. And we were in Virginia that wasn't dry. And 100 feet away past the beer store was a dry county. And one car after another, all day long would cross the county line over the ridge cut in the mountain to come to the beer store. Did you experience that?
Well, you know, the radio station you were sitting in was an old beer store.
Oh, the building itself was a beer store.
At one time, GC took it over, but that was WIFX, and they have since moved from there. But that's Pound Gap is the name of that place. It's this Pound on the Virginia side and Jenkins on the Letcher County side. And yeah, I lived down there for about 10 years.
Wow, Wow. Well, good times, but we're going to talk about more current good times coming up. Hey, our show This Week in Radio Tech, episode 431 with Don Mussel coming to us live from the island of Kauai, and he's got pictures from mountaintop transmitter sites all over Hawaii. So, hey, if you're listening to this show, fine, but let me suggest you get the video version of this show because you're going to want to see the pictures of these incredible mountaintop transmitter sites all across Hawaii that Don takes care of. Our show, This Week in Radio Tech, is brought to you in part by our friends at Angry Audio. Let's see what they have to say. You know, studio guests are only human, and humans cough, and they sniff, and they clear their throats even on the air. You can cure this with Angry Audio's Guest Gizmo. Press the cough button, mute the mic. Every guest needs one. You know what else guests need? Headphones, which is why each Guest Gizmo also has a studio-quality headphone amp with individual volume control. Anything else? Well, you've seen those mic arms with the built-in LED tallies. They're gorgeous. So how do you light them up? Well, the Guest Gizmo does that too, illuminating the red light whenever the mic is hot. And installing the Guest Gizmo in your studio furniture is easy. You just need a 2 3/4 inch hole saw and a steady hand. You don't have to have a router to put these things in. Just make a round hole, your studio gets a clean, custom appearance, and you get all the credit. So check out the Guest Gizmo and all the other cool gadgets at angryaudio.com. Angryaudio.com. Thanks, Angry Audio, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, Chris, you haven't met Don before, and I got to meet Don last year in 2018 when I was there building a studio for KHKU-FM in Kauai. Don, why don't you kind of fill us in on let's start with the most recent thing with that station, and then we can go talk about some other stuff. But tell us about KHKU and the transmitter site that you've added us to.
Well, there are only a few choices on an island like this. The population rings the outside of the island near the coastline. There's hardly anybody in the interior. And so the mountains are in the interior. So what you got to do is you got to find a spot, being FM, being line of sight, you got to find someplace that'll reach everybody out on the ring and not worry about the interior. Well, there's only a couple choices. The best spot on island to put a transmitter for FM would be Mount Waialeale, which is in the center of the island. It's 5,200 feet above sea level, but there's no power and there's no access unless you want to go in a helicopter. And helicopter access is pretty limited because of the weather at 5,200 feet. Cloud level tends to sit right around 3,500 feet. And that's the general good weather day. So Mount Kahili, which is where I already had an established FM site for a couple stations, is at 3,000 feet. And it's somewhat south, on the south side of the island. And so that's the established spot. And when the folks at KHKU came by and said, well, we need to serve our city of license, I said, it's on the south shore. You won't be able to reach it from anywhere else except for the mountaintop. And it's a very difficult mountaintop to reach because it's helicopter only as well. And the power is kind of undependable and there's no generator. And if you're willing to accept that and accept downtime from time to time, that would work for you.
We should... If I can, you mentioned our city of license, and I'm familiar with KHKU. I'm actually teeny tiny part owner, and I built the studios, but we had to depend on your expertise for where to put the transmitter site. And indeed, the city of license is Hanapepe, which is not exactly the city of financial interest, if you want to put it that way. The studios are in Lihue, which is the biggest town on the island. And you had to suggest a spot, like you said, that would cover the city of license and still do the best we could cover, the biggest part of the population. I want to see if Suncast has any pictures from KHKU teed up yet and ready to go. We'll see if that's somewhere. Well, I'll tell you what. Since it's hard for Suncast to pick out exactly the right pictures, why don't we just spend a few minutes and you give us this beautiful travelogue tour of these pictures we have to look at, and we'll come back to specifics on KHKU in a few minutes.
Okay.
Go ahead, Suncast. Let's take a look at the picture.
There we go. That's Haleakala. That's not quite at the top. There's a big observatory you can see off. Look at the big white building up there. That's a 140-foot tall solar observatory. The rest of the observatories are behind the top. You can see a little bit of an antenna sticking up way up there, and that's the FAA. There's about 10 observatories up there. This is 10,000 feet above sea level. And
And then this is on Oahu?
This is on Maui.
This is on Maui. Okay.
Yep. This is the top of the mountain on Maui, which if we were to take a picture today, it would be covered in snow. There's ice on the antenna systems.
Oh, geez.
Last time I checked, the temperature was 37 degrees up here.
Wow.
And that's not entirely, I mean, yeah, well, you can imagine what a normal 14,000 watts from our site up there reaches. I can hear it here at home. It's 200 miles away.
Well, wait a minute. You're on a different island. You're several islands away to the northwest, right?
Yeah.
On Kauai. Yeah. Kauai is the farthest west island, and Maui is almost the farthest east island, right?
It's center east. Yeah, it's it's about 200 miles from here. Hilo on the Big Island is about 350 miles. So this is a bigger place than most people imagine. And if they've never been here, they have no idea what the layout of this whole place is like. But so part of my job living here way out on the western end of the state is to take care of all the transmitters from here to the east, 350 miles thereabouts. And so I can't drive to any other island.
Right.
I haven't figured out an amphibious way of getting about. So right. I have to get on the airplane to go. And Maui's not too bad. There's a direct flight from Kauai to Maui. You get to Maui and get I have a friend of mine. Usually we both go up together. We don't like to go up there by ourselves because it's a little spooky. If something happens, you're a long ways from help at that point. Top of the Haleakala is at least an hour and a half from civilization. So anyway, up there, yeah, the coverage is great. It's astounding. And the problem is all these considerations have to come into effect because 10,000 feet means transmitter derating, antenna derating from elevation all have to be thought about when you're designing something like that. And then, like, for example, I'm looking on my other computer over here, looking at the transmitter over there, which is the antenna systems are currently iced up. And I can only run, I hate to say it, it says 150 watts is what I'm running out of each one of those, which is about 600 watts ERP. But at 10,000 feet, 600 watts goes everywhere.
Can we take a look at that that picture once again? Suncast, can you put that same picture up on the screen? Are there FM bays in this picture? I'm not quite picking them out.
This particular picture, no, it doesn't have them there because we hadn't taken down some of those dishes on the right-hand tower. They're down. They're out of the way now, and there's an antenna array on the left leg that takes up the whole 70 feet of that tower. Four bays plus the tuning sections. Anyway, and there's another antenna on the other side, and there's a little tower sticking up. You can see at the top, that's the owner put that up as an experiment, and there's a two-bay antenna hanging off of that. So, yeah, near as I can tell, it survived this last weekend. So you could probably use it still. We had 90-mile-an-hour winds out there.
Let's have a look at the next pick. 90-mile-an-hour winds up there. Oh, what's this?
This is Mauna Loa, where I have the tower in the very middle, sort of in the background there. That's my 60-foot tower there I use for microwave relay. Way off in the distance, you see the coastline. That's Hilo, but we're 30-some-odd miles above Hilo up on the top of the volcano. And I use this to relay from Maui down to Hilo. And it's a chore getting up here. Part of the problem with my job is that taking care of transmitters, putting them in, maintaining them, it's not a big deal. It's like everywhere else. It's the same, except I have to get there.
Mm-hmm.
You may notice that the ground here is a little rough at this Mauna Loa. Well, that's lava. That's old lava. And That was this particular lava we see in front of us was going by at 30 miles an hour in 1984. And
what? It's that fresh, that lava?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. In fact, it missed my tower by about 300 feet. And everything else, it missed a little bit, and we survived up there. But, yeah, to the right is the PBS. On the far right is the PBS TV tower pointed down at Hilo. And then the one right in front of us is the state microwave relay. So, but, you know, this is what happens up here, especially on the Big Island, which is still an active set of volcanoes. Mauna Loa is still active. It's quiet. The top of the mountain is about 4 miles behind where I'm standing when I took the picture. And it occasionally belches big things of steam. And I have to be sort of on my toes because if it does anything like it did back in 84, I probably have about 10 minutes to get out. But it hasn't gone off yet. So.
On a number of our shows, Chris and I have discussed hazards, either getting to and from transmitter sites or at the transmitter site. And we have had forest fires in California last fall, yeah. Right? And snakes and cows and bad guys with ill intent, drug deals gone bad, you know, all kinds of hazards. But lava, I don't think has been mentioned on our – Chris, have we talked about lava at the transmitter site? Oh, sorry, Chris. I didn't mean to.
My fault. Sorry.
That's all right.
I had to step away. No, we have not talked about lava flows or anything.
I didn't
of that
think
sort.
So.
No, that's a good one. And you only have 10 minutes to evacuate. That's even better. That's so. Is that when you pull out the single flying suit and you just strap it around, kick on the afterburners, and go straight up and out?
That would probably be a better idea. Yeah, I have to go on roads that take me through the old fields of lava, and I have to get past those. And it's about 10 minutes to get through those before you get down to a point where you're far enough away. You just keep moving. You don't stop. But, you know, it's a little different.
I'm curious, is the surface of hardened lava, you know, that's not flowing, is that sharp or abrasive? You know, if you're driving a vehicle that, you know, do you need not special tires, but something very durable to get across it? Or is it just like rough asphalt?
It's beyond rough asphalt. It's like it's like driving on a lava field. It's totally choppy. The Hawaiian words for the what lava looks like after it's cooled off is a-a and o-o. And a-a is the smooth stuff. Well, you can sort of drive on it, but not really. And no, you can't drive on that at all because it's sticking up in spikes and it's going to cut your tires and no, it doesn't work. So
wow,
very appropriately named.
Wow.
So
how do you form? How do you create a road on a lava field like that? Do you just drive on it? Is that it?
A big D3 dozer works pretty well.
Okay.
Because it's crinkly stuff. It's lightweight.
Oh yeah. Okay. Okay.
But you have to dig a pathway through it and you know, they've built roads up there without a problem. It just, you know, you don't want to drive on that stuff without treating it ahead of time.
Let's have a look at our next pick, Suncast.
Okay.
See what we got. We'll get surprised.
Yeah.
Oh.
This is also the Big Island. This is I'm up on the tower about 200 feet looking out towards the volcano, the Kilauea active volcano, and in fact, you see a plume of smoke out there in the distance. That is the caldera. We're 7 miles from the caldera at this tower site, and we're uphill from it. Getting to this tower is a major chore. It's 25 miles from town, which is off to the left. And the volcano, at the time when I took this, was about 2 years ago. We were getting earthquakes every day. So in order to build a transmitter site in these kind of environments, knowing what you have coming potentially at you, everything's bolted down to the floor and seismically retrofitted.
Mm-hmm.
And we're uphill from this volcano, so it tends to flow the other way. And it's 7 miles uphill.
How do towers fare in those kind of earthquakes, and freestanding towers, self-supporters, as opposed to guide towers? What do they suffer?
Stress. If shaking is big, you have to come out and have them inspected and structurally fitted. And we had to replace a bunch of things on the tower we're at up at Kulani Cone because it hadn't been maintained. And some of the cross members were either broken or cracked. Seeing real big, thick steel cracked is a humbling experience. So we had a crew up there working on it for about 4 months, replacing all the cross members and getting everything straightened out. And it's fine now, but you have to maintain stuff. You have to pay attention. You have to not afraid to look, you know.
When you have an earthquake in an area like that, do the guy anchor points for a guide tower, do the guy anchor points shift in relation to the base of the tower?
Well, if it's that big of an earthquake, you're lucky you're going to have the tower after that. No, the earthquakes tend to be small and regular. We had last year, we had when that eruption happened in May, we had a 6.7, I think it was. And the tower itself did fine. It just wiggled in the air like that and then stopped. And the inside of the building, everything was tied to the floor. Everything bolted down. So it made a lot of noise, but everything was still working. And electricity was still on. So,
Wow. Let's see what picture we got next.
Okay.
That one. And
yes.
That's there we go.
Oh,
what's that?
Now, you can tell this is an older island. This is Oahu. This is upper reaches above. Actually, we're only about 6 miles above Waikiki. But if I turned around the other direction and showed you, you'd see the stuff down by the ocean and all that stuff. This is looking up into the interior of Oahu. And that tower that's sticking up out of the bamboo is the one I put up in 2008. It's only 110 feet tall. But it has, in this picture, it only shows our 5-bay antenna. There's now auxiliary antennas, and there's another station on that pole as well. So there's microwave dishes on it. The top one is pointed back to the studio, and the one down below on the right-hand side of the tower, that's looking at Maui, which is about 110 miles from that tower.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. And how is power delivered to that site?
Well, through a very tenuous single-phase line going up the hill, there's a little bit of a telephone pole you can see sticking up out of the bamboo just to the left of the tower. You see the cross pole on the top.
Yeah, I barely saw it there. Yeah.
Down a little
there
bit. There you go.
There's the cross member. Right. Yeah.
And we have a generator up there, and the generator's got 500 gallons of fuel in it, and we're prepared for days of being without power, which has happened in the past.
Oh, my goodness.
Trees fall over, and that's the biggest problem we've had up there is just having trees fall over and knock the power lines down.
Can you drive to that site?
Yeah, it's paved all the way. Unbelievable. Oh. It's a great spot. And so is Haleakala on Maui. I can drive all the way to the top, totally paved in a regular passenger car. Works great.
Wow.
So I'm spoiled in some ways. The problem is the distance, once again. If I'm driving from the airport, I got to be prepared for an hour and a half drive to the top of the mountain, even though I can see it. It's right there. But
of course.
It's 2 miles. Yeah. It's 2 miles in the air. 2 miles above sea level, and you know, and a lot of zigzaggy roads all the way up. So
that's from Eastern Kentucky, where you certainly spent some years. It's not quite that bad. But there was a site that GC went to in the national parks that you couldn't get there by car; it had to be a 4-wheeler, and it was a good 45 minutes on a 4-wheeler to get to it.
And I've walked that a number of times too. So
wow. Wow.
That's what you got to do sometimes.
Let's see what picture's next, Suncast, if you want to flip us to the next one.
Ooh. Yeah. This is Mount Kahili. This is my island on Kauai. This is the looking out towards the big Wili Wili Harbor on the left side and Lihue, the main town. And the main ridgeline there that's separating us from the south coast. Most people know about Poipu, this big town on the south coast. Hanapepe is off to the right, off the picture frame. But, yeah, we're about 3,000 feet up here above Hawaii. And once again, it's hard to know that this exists because you can't get there. There's no road up here at all. Now you have to fly.
You have to fly. You can walk. Wow. Yeah.
Well, you can walk, but good luck. You know, carrying stuff of any substantial weight is too much of a task.
And I've seen some other pictures of this site where the you've done an amazing job of fitting several FM stations together at the site, but it's got more antennas than it was designed to have, I think.
It was never designed for FM at all. It was put up actually originally that tower, the pole that we use, was put up as a replacement pole in 1993 after the 1992 hurricane that came through. There was an anemometer up there who was put up by the cable company because they were using the site as a relay point for their two-way radios. And the anemometer they got via telemetry, it would key in and they get the wind reading. And the last reading on the day of September 11th, 1992, when Hurricane Niki was coming through, the last reading was 226.
Oh, my goodness.
And then it disappeared. Oh. It was gone.
I wonder why.
I don't know.
226 miles an hour.
Jeez. I have pictures of the remnants of that, plus the building before it got hit. And it took a while. It took about 6 months to rebuild the site. And since then, they put in a single telephone pole as opposed to a big structure. Something round and slender was conceived to be the right way to survive such a thing. And we put a building up that's a triangular structure that seems to put up with the wind pretty well.
I guess as different walls pushed against each other, a four-sided building can parallelogram topple, whereas triangular building doesn't necessarily. Wow, good idea.
Right. As we say around here, Akamai, which means smart. So that's what's it, and it's been there since 93 and it's working fine and it's very tiny. So there's not a whole lot of room to move around and the pole is very full of antennas at this point. But over time, when I lived in Eastern Kentucky, I learned about sharing sites and putting antennas on the same tower and filtering and all the other stuff you've got to do. That's really above and beyond a lot of normal installations where you have lots of room and you have space to put things on the pole. Everything's crammed together on these sites on Hawaii, so everything has to coexist. And filtering, bandpass filters, notch filters, it's an art, a black art in some respects.
I'm not sure if there are any pictures of this in the photos that we have, but where does a helicopter land at a site like that?
There are pictures in that gallery, but your guy's going to have to figure out where they are. I take thousands of pictures because part of the problem I have is my memory's not that good. You'd be surprised. It really isn't. So the only way I can remember things is take pictures of everything. So typically I'll take a couple thousand photos of each site and put up a select number of them on the online version of it, mostly so that people can see what I'm seeing. Because not everybody comes along.
You want to be able to document and show people what you saw. Well, hey, let's look at one more picture before we take our commercial break. Suncast, what you got next for us?
That was the last one.
Oh, that's the last one. Well, there were some other albums, right, Don?
There's a bunch of them there. Yeah.
Okay. Well, tell you what. Let's have Suncast get us into our next break. And I'm sure you've got some stories to tell. And maybe maybe take a moment to do that for us when we come back. Our show this week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by. Let's see, Suncast. Are we ready to do the Pro Mix ad? We got the Lavo ad. Let's hear from our friends at Lavo. And we'll be right back. More with Don Mussle. Chris Tobin is along, and I'm sure Chris will have some questions about engineering in paradise. We'll be right back.
There has probably never been a better time in history to buy a new radio mixing console. Today's consoles are more sophisticated than ever, with more features and functions than you can shake a stick at. But have you noticed how complicated they are? There's a sea of knobs and switches and displays and buttons. Some of them look like you might need a pilot's license to do your show. Well, a board doesn't have to be complicated to be powerful. Just look at the new Ruby mixing surface from Lavo. The first thing you notice is how smooth and streamlined it is. Ruby has lots of cool tech, but what it doesn't have is that confusing ocean of buttons that clutter things up. Now, we all know that there are some console features the Jock only uses once in a while. So why dedicate controls to them? Ruby fixes this problem by moving those once-in-a-blue-moon controls to a touch-sensitive, customizable GUI that happily shares screen space with your other studio software, helping you fight control room clutter. Thanks to this design innovation, talent that use Ruby produce smoother shows with less errors. Controls that are used the most fall naturally to hand, while functions that rarely need adjustment are easily controlled with just a couple of clicks in the context-sensitive GUI. And Ruby has cool features you won't find on other boards, like Auto Mix, an intelligent gain writing function that guarantees the perfect mix for multi-mic morning shows and call-in segments. Dual mode snapshots that instantly switch the motorized faders between on-air and production modes. And enough DSP and I/O options to make even your pro sound pals green with envy. And because quality is as important to Lavo as it is to you, every console is proudly built to fanatically precise standards at Lavo's own factory in Germany. If you're ready to declutter your control room, do yourself a favor. Check out the new Ruby and the other cool Lavo radio tech at www.lawo.com/twert.
And if you would, be sure you add that /twert when you go to Lavo.com. That'll take you right to the section where they have radio consoles and other radio products. And also, it'll let them know that you went there because we asked you to, or because you were interested and you heard it from here. How about that? Thanks, Lavo, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, Chris Tobin is along, and so is Don Mussel. He's an engineer in Hawaii. It kind of sounds like a dream job that a lot of engineers would like to have. Don, maybe you can take a minute and maybe tell us why it may not be a dream job. I've always wanted, you know, being a weatherman in San Diego, that'd be so cool. Be a weatherman in Honolulu, that'd be so cool. Why would I not actually want to be an engineer in Hawaii?
I'm not sure I can answer that because I have a problem doing this, but it requires a commitment to, all right, time to get on the airplane again, time to go over to that other island. Oh, gosh, I got to rent a car, or I got to grab the truck that I have in the storage. I've got to deal with a lot of logistical things that mainland engineers, as we say here, don't have to deal with, at least to a certain extent. You know, if you live in the Rocky Mountains or you live on the West Coast where you're dealing with high mountains, yeah, you're going to be dealing with some logistical challenges. Let's put it that way. There are a bunch of mountains that are hard to reach. You got to have four-wheel drive or who knows what to get up there, snow trackers and all that. And, you know, you wouldn't think that that'd be necessary in Hawaii, but yeah, right now we're snowed in up at Haleakala and I can't get there and the Park Service closed the roads, so I can't get there to refuel the generator, which has been running since Sunday, things like that. So it's a challenge. And the other thing about Hawaii is that it's population-wise, we're 1.5 million people total in the state. Honolulu and Oahu is where most people live. There's about 1 million people on that island and a commensurate amount of radio stations, and there's not enough engineers for everybody. And so those of us who are tasked with taking care of some things wind up having a bunch of hats and have to deal with travel and getting there and dealing with mom and pop operations for the most part. iHeartMedia is on Oahu, and so are a couple other larger companies, but for the most part, it's mom and pop radio. So the pay is not that great, and it's like dealing with small towns in the United States mainland. So there's all that, getting paid properly.
Yeah.
And yeah. All that. So I came here originally back in the early 90s to build a small station here on Kauai, a non-commercial station. And that went pretty well. We got them on the air in 1997, and they're still thriving. They're doing fine. Part of the reason they're doing okay is because there's no competition. There's just a few stations on the island, and it's even that way on the Big Island and Maui. There's more going on those islands, but there's still not the population base that provides advertising to a certain extent that maybe you can. All right, let's say that you're, you know, in somewhere in the Midwest and you want to grab the advertisement from that town that's 20 miles away. Well, great. But there's no 20 miles away here. We're all restricted to our little rocks, you know, and radio markets are restricted to the islands themselves. There's no advertising available to a Kauai radio station on Oahu because it's 110 miles away. Yeah. Same thing with Maui. They can't reach advertisers on the Oahu. So it becomes a bunch of small towns, basically. So, and that's the limitation.
Talk to me about you do engineering for the public broadcasters there, public broadcaster, and that's a different setup than a commercial broadcaster because aren't they sending similar programming to all the islands?
Yeah, it was so quiet over here for so long. They not only grabbed one main frequency, they grabbed two. Why not? And they have two separate programming streams for Hawaii Public Radio. One is all classical music, and the other is all news, talk, information, and everything else. And so their idea back when they first found me, they kind of kidnapped me, actually. I was very happy sitting over here on Kauai, taking it easy, you know? This is the dream, you know? Okay, I got one little station, I'm fine, that's good. Oh, whoops, they found me. And they grabbed me. Dragging it over Oahu, and next thing I know, I'm part of their statewide plan to build coverage over everybody. And reaching logistically, it's like a statewide network in the Midwest, like in Wisconsin and West Virginia. All those, but the difference is you can't drive to all those places. And each island is like their own kingdom, and you have to deal with all the logistical and cultural situations that are on each island. So Kirk, you know this, dealing with American Samoa, it's the same kind of thing down there. Wait, you want to go over to the islands that are 50 miles away? All right, well, that's might as well be another planet. So it's the same kind of thing here.
I think Suncast is going to have some more photos in a minute, but tell me, one of the things that I was just agog at when you were telling, when I was there in Hawaii, and you were telling me about long STL paths. And okay, I'm used to, you know, have we engineered this well enough to make it 15 miles? You know, I've got a really long path. I've got an 18 mile path here, you know, and then you throw out the 3-digit number for the number of miles in a 950 megahertz path. And I'm just like, talk to me about that.
Well, there are a number of factors that make this place different, not to mention all the things that everybody can think about. The temperature of the water in the ocean doesn't change that much here. Wintertime temperatures of the ocean can drop almost to 75 degrees. And in the summer, they can go as high as 80. But that's not a very big temperature swing. And so temperature inversions don't really happen. If they do, they're very short-lived and they don't have any support. So I found, because of my earlier experience in California, putting in an STL path over the Monterey Bay from Santa Cruz to Mount Toro, which is 36 miles, partially over water and ocean water that changes dramatically summer, winter, and the ground temperature, which changes dramatically, Mosley, who sold me that STL package back in the 70s, they said, well, we'll sell it to you. We won't buy it back from you. It won't work. And I said, well, okay, but I'm willing to try. And I put it up and it worked fine. And yes, once a year or so during usually the fall, inversion was set up strong enough that I would get these instantaneous dropouts on my 950. But over than that, I was like, no, it seems to work fine. So when I got here to Hawaii, I thought, well, this is interesting. How am I going to reach with a statewide network all these other islands that are sprinkled out 350 miles apart altogether? Well, I don't know what the actual limitation is at this point, but right now my Oahu to Maui links are 110 miles long. They go from a 2,000-foot mountain to 10,000 feet. Not a problem at all. And And then from Maui to Big Island, it's 92 miles. And then from the top of Mauna Loa down to town is 30 miles. And up from there, 25 miles. And I'm doing a 40-mile shot. I'm just putting that in right now from the volcano, which is right above. Anyway, it's 40 miles, and it goes to South Point. And I've already tested it. It works fine. So,
And these are 950 links. Do they tend to be the mostly digital stuff, or are they analog? What's going across there?
The digital stuff doesn't seem to work all that well. The bandwidth occupancy of digital is pretty fat, takes up the whole carrier, and analog punches through better. So guess what? We're analog out here. Okay. It works fine.
Okay.
Nobody on the listening end knows the difference.
So your longest hop is 110 miles, 950 megahertz. Talk to me about, do you have an amplifier on the transmitter? How big are the dishes? What kind of coax you got going to the dishes?
These are, they tend to be either the Martys or the Bext or whatever I can, all analog stuff. And they're barefoot, 6 watts.
Whoa, and then, six, wow.
on Oahu, I send the signal to Maui with a 6-foot dish, and on Maui, on the top of the mountain, I have an 8-foot dish to pick it up. But it's overkill. The signals are pegged. I've got 1,000 microvolts without a problem. There's nothing in the way, and the inversions aren't there to mess with the signal all that much. So it's like you shine a light, you'll see it, kind of thing. The same thing works from Oahu to here on Kauai. I've got a 96-mile path to the site up there. So
when you were dialing in the 110-mile link, did you get any pushback or raised eyebrows from the tower crews? Or is it like, no, this is normal. It's okay.
No, they said, oh, it's Don. He's got it figured out. Okay. I did all that stuff ahead of time. I figured out what the azimuth's going to be. And I had to figure out the declination and everything else. And it's usually within a couple degrees. It was enough. We'd get a signal, and then they'd peak it up, and I'd be on one end, and they'd be on the other. We'd be on the cell phone, and we'd nail it down and tighten everything up. And that was all there was to it. It's kind of magical in some ways. I didn't expect it to be that easy.
If Chris Tobin is handy, Chris, I've done a few STL links, but nothing of 110 miles. You got any comment about that?
No, 110 miles I have not done, but I'm assuming, Don, at some of your sites, the RF noise floor is probably quite low. That makes it convenient for you to be able to do 950 in analog and not have too much issues, or am I mistaken?
Maui is the exception because at 10,000 feet on the receive end, I can see Oahu perfectly, and everything from Oahu is pounding in up there. Everything from Maui is pounding in up there. Everything from the Big Island is coming in from there. So I have to coordinate this stuff to the point where I'm thinking not of my local market, but who on Oahu is sharing this frequency? Okay, I'm going to cross polarize. I'm going to offset the frequencies by 150 kilohertz or whatever. All that has to be thought about.
And I understand.
Interesting.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah. But you said when you get the right, so you're getting 1,000 microvolts, and that's with a composite STL. That's a good safe amount of signal to have. That's full full quieting, isn't it?
Oh yeah, it's more than 25 dB of fade margin. So, and like I said, occasionally we do have trouble. We were having more trouble when the volcano was going off on the Big Island, and we get what they call VOG, which is volcanic smoke. From that, and it sometimes would come up the whole island chain, all 350 miles, and the particulate matter in that in VOG would occasionally get thick enough to cause reflections and whatnot. So in order to plan for that, I have analog backup picking up the main signals from the other state, from the other islands, and there's enough signal at that height, you can hear everything. The FM dial is just jam-packed at 10,000 feet high. I don't know if you've ever flown in an airplane across the United States and happened to have one of those little tiny portable radios with you. And
oh, yes.
At 30,000 feet, you can hear everybody.
Yes. So, yeah. Yes. for three stations on every channel.
Yeah. So that's the way it works at 10,000 feet as well. So it's just a different environment to have to deal with. And there's enough noise out here. Yeah.
Suncast has more of these pictures lined up for us. I'm not sure okay. We knew that they were albums. So Suncast, what you got next for us? Oh, what's going on here?
This is putting together the RF system at Haleakala. This is inside the building, which is an old Hawaiian telecom telephone company building with 12-inch concrete walls. And, yeah, we're putting in the feed line there, which is 1 5/8. These are 5-kilowatt Nautil transmitters, which I can't run any higher than about 4 kilowatts. I'm running them at 3.75 because they have to be power derated for the elevation.
And yeah, the thin air, right? Yeah.
You're right. And the coax is 1 5/8 for 3.5 kilowatts. And even at that, they run warm.
Wow. Okay, let's see what's next, Suncast.
Yeah. Oh, you see the ferrite beads there, too. Yeah, there we are.
Yeah.
Not only do we have hangers, you know, we have to put ferrite everywhere to wrap around the coax because at 10,000 feet, oh, today was a great example. Last night we had lightning all night long up there. And it strikes the tower at great regularity. And we have a big ring ground system around the whole building and lots of wires trailing off into the distance and lots of ferrite filters and a big 4-inch ground strap everywhere. It's a little more robust than most people have to deal with. It's like Florida on steroids, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Next picture. So I'm guessing, let's see a few more here.
This is inside the Haleakala building itself. Same site. Yeah. You see where everything's stuffed again. I had to coexist with the telephone company equipment up there. They have all of their fiber interconnects and their old analog interconnects. And the other half of the building is filled with microwave gear that they're still using as backup at this point. Mm-hmm. They're afraid to get rid of it.
I do think it's interesting. You've got Nautil transmitters, which are, you know, pretty much top of technology, and you've got BEXT STLs there, which, you know, are, there's nothing wrong with them. They're just, you know, good old solid analog stuff, and that's what works for you.
And the other secret, of course, is that I have backups for everything. The microwave gear, every piece of the microwave gear has a companion that's turned off, disconnected, ready to go, because that's what happens with the problem with analog gear is that there's very few people making it anymore. And even Marty under BE is having trouble with keeping up. I just ordered a bunch of links for the Big Island, and those are BE Marty's. And so anyway, I have spare fans. I have spare PA assemblies. I have all this other stuff. The other thing about being out here in Hawaii is that spare parts, you want them now? You want them next week? So I stock up everything, and it seems like totally luxurious to have backups of backups, but that's what I have to do to keep things on the air and repair things in a timely manner. So it's got more challenges than most other places. And you know this from American Samoa. You want to win? Is that even part of the United States?
Yeah. Right.
You have a post office there? Oh, my gosh.
Well, and Hawaii, you get deliveries, you know, numerous times a day, but it's still expensive to get stuff there overnight, to get stuff there quickly.
Yeah. Although FedEx and UPS run just fine here, and I can get stuff in the post office in 2 days here from the West Coast. So it's not that hard.
Let's buzz through just a few more picks before we take our last what's that?
This is up at Haleakala again, and this is, now you can see the thickness of the ceiling there. That's the roof, solid concrete as well. And we're putting in a backup microwave dish that's hanging outside around the lee side of the building, so it's sheltered from the wind. That's a backup. It's already ready to go. And we'll move that or twist it around as needed. Go ahead.
I think our viewers should take note of the way the mast is mounted to the building. That we've done this in American Samoa. We've built custom built these masts that attach to the wall and then stick out so that they can just clear the roof overhang and give us some mast above the roof line too. I think it's a great design.
Yeah, and you notice we don't use little 2-inch pipes.
Yeah. Damn.
They'll fold over.
Yeah, yeah. Let's take a look at this. Oh, wow. This is back at
home. This is the tower in Haleakala, the one that's got ice on it right now.
Wow.
Yeah, it's actually a pretty easy one to work on. We tried using this method to hold up that antenna. It didn't work. A couple weeks after we put this up to point it at the Big Island, which is out in the distance there, it twisted all the way around from the wind.
Oh, and wow.
It needed a reinforcement pole, so we just decided to go with a bigger, heavier everything. So these dishes work okay as long as you prop them up and you brace them on either side. But it's very extreme weather up there. You can't put them up like, slap it to the side of the building with 2-inch pipe. Like I was saying, that's a 2-inch pipe there holding it up. Well, it got bent. It got twisted in the wind. So
what's next here? Okay.
Yeah, more that'd be the same. Yeah. You note that the tower itself is put together. It's at the base is 7-inch solid rod, and up at the upper it's 6-inch solid rod.
Wow!
This is the backup antenna hookup. So this is the 1 5/8 to Oh, okay. This is
what was that?
This is the
mic. If I can interrupt on that last slide with the rigid line.
Yes,
I see frequencies marked 54 to 806 megahertz. On the SWR labels. What exactly is, I mean, I have an idea, but what's going on there?
Well, they'll work for those frequencies, but I use them for FM. That's a conversion from 1 5/8 to, believe it or not, that's 1 5/8 taking it to 3-inch and then dropping it back down to 7/8. So that's the best
I
can
do. I recognize the conversion. I just never seen those particular units with the frequencies on them. That's why I was like, wait a minute. They've been swept for the frequencies. Right, that's interesting.
It'll work for any of those frequencies. So it's pretty compatible. That slide you were on just before this one. This is the view from the Mauna Loa volcano site looking at Haleakala 92 miles away. And in fact, that mountain you see in the distance is Haleakala. And the next one in sequence, if these are in sequence, I'm not sure if they will be. There you go. Now you see Haleakala a little clearer. And one more will show you the actual where we're looking. The left-hand peak up there has got the big observatory, and we're down in the saddle of that.
Yeah.
And that's 92 miles away.
92 miles away. Look at that.
This is why microwave works there. There's a clear line of sight. There's nothing in the way.
Amazing.
Just the way it is.
I'm sure there are people in the Western U.S. Where kind of similar, links can be done, but still it's amazing to have it explained and to see it. And then just the fact that it's from one island to another and there's ocean in between, that just increases the separation from these two sites.
It makes
it
more
amazing. Oh my goodness. Oh my. Let's hit a few more pictures before we take our last break here. What we got?
Oh, there's the view from Haleakala looking down to the Big Island. In fact, off to the far right of the picture, you see a little bit of Mauna Loa sticking up. That's where our site is over there, 92 miles away.
Okay.
And the top of Mauna Kea that was just there, that's almost 14,000 feet high. It's covered with snow. Now, we wanted to put both stations at Haleakala on the same antenna. No sense putting up two, so we had to buy combiners. And there's our wonderful Nautel combiner, which is designed for 10,000 watts for each combiner cavity. But once again, because of elevation, they're derated 50%. So they're only good for 5,000 watts.
And they
work like a charm.
Yeah.
What's that?
Yeah. They match your transmitters,
Yes, yes.
The rating is the derating, Wow.
Yeah, it's tricky stuff. Oh, yes, the weather. It's not always pretty up there.
No, there it's not surfing weather up there.
No. In fact, this last weekend, it was, we had a peak of about 90, 90 some odd miles an hour at the tower of wind. And 4 days before that, I was up there. It was 55 degrees and 10 miles an hour. You want predictable? No.
Quite variable. This has been a lot of fun. We've got Don, in your experience and travels, I'm sure you've got a tip for us coming up. We're going to take a break and hear what you might have to, what you might want to leave our listeners and viewers with in terms of a bit of wisdom. And Chris Tobin always has a tip for us as well. So we'll hear from, and you know what? I've actually got one too. I've got one too. So I'll have a tip too. Our show this week in Radio Tech, we're talking to Don Mussel. He's an engineer. He lives in Kauai, and he engineers for radio stations across the Hawaiian Islands. Covers one state, but boy, is it some travel to get from one place to another. Sounds idyllic. Not always, though. Our show this week in Radio Tech, episode 431, is brought to you by our friends at Broadcast Tools. They make this thing called the ProMix 4, and this is a pretty amazing device. Now, it may sound a little odd to you when I describe what its features are, but hey, hear me out and take a listen here. The ProMix 4 is a full-featured audio mixing console. It's perfect for most any broadcast studio while also excelling in remote broadcast and podcasting. Now, it has three microphone and or line inputs, as well as a dedicated line input that can be switched between a balanced line input and the internal USB connection. It also gives you a program limiter. So you've got some people who aren't quite careful with the levels, or somebody wants to shout from time to time, they get excited, no problem. A balanced and an unbalanced mix bus and a mix minus output as well. So if you want to bring somebody in on a hybrid or a codec, you got that mix minus bus right there. It offers three independent headphone amps built right in, and also an IFB program pan controls, along with a comprehensive studio monitoring system. So it also has three, as I mentioned, those universal mic monaural line input channels. It does have that USB connection, an LED audio output level meter, full duplex talkback capability, IFB audio input with level adjustment, the headphone jacks. It can drive multiple AHR 1 plus headphone systems. And it could be combined with additional ProMix 4 or ProMix 1 units, along with the ProMix Hub 6 and standard Cat 5 cables. But that means you can expand it, just plug it together with the Cat 5 cables, and you've got a bigger system. Pretty cool. It also does have an on-air tally warning light output. So if you need to, you know, put that in your studio, you got it. The ProMix 4 from Broadcast Tools. Yeah, this thing is simple and easy to use. Yeah, it's mono. This is not for, you know, big stereo production. This is to get it done in a podcast, a remote broadcast, maybe some simple voiceover capabilities. And it's easy to carry around. Not bad looking either. You take it to the ball game, to the parade, to the city council meeting, wherever news is happening or sports is happening, wherever you need to do a remote broadcast, and this can really help you out. The IFB functionality is cool too for podcasts when you want to bring a caller in or somebody on a codec or even on, you know, Skype, something like that. You bring them in that way, and that can work really well for you. Broadcast Tools ProMix 4, where do you get it? Well, you call our friends at Broadcasters General Store. You can go there at bgs.cc, go to their website. And hey, I just spent part of the week with Dave Kirsten of Broadcasters General Store. Great guy, great family operation there, and the folks there really know what they're doing. Give them a call, 352-622-7700 for Broadcasters General Store. We appreciate them and Broadcast Tools sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. All right, it's time for some tips of the week before we let you go. And my quick tip is this. We forget about those little button batteries that are in almost every computer. And you lose the button battery, everything's fine until the power goes out. And then your BIOS becomes stupid and probably doesn't know that it's supposed to come back on when the power is restored. Well, buy you some button batteries. You can order these from, you know, Amazon. You can probably get them off eBay, but you know, I'd get Amazon and get some fresh ones. I've used one out of here and I've got four more to go. Most computers use what CR2032 button battery, although you better check your motherboard to be sure. And I got about 20 of these just on hand around the office. And you know, every year or so, I'll just go, you know, I better go replace this or that. And of course, still I miss something, but, you know, try to keep those replaced, especially, you know, in your broadcast gear that's PC based. You don't want that to go off and not come back on when it should. So there you go. Get some of these. They're cheap when you buy them in bulk, and you can just go around and get them replaced. That's my tip of the week. Let's see. Chris Tobin, do you have a tip for us today?
Sure. Since we're talking about backups and redundancy and possibly running on diesel alternate power sources during normal days or inclement weather, just a reminder, this may seem like this is not a phaser from Star Trek. However, it is a flashlight.
Ah.
And what happens is when you lose power, it turns on.
Oh.
Look at that. It's got a battery. It senses voltage loss. So I have these in all the studios when you oh, by the way, when you do get these for your studios and even offices if you choose, don't plug them into the UPS outlet. Plug them into the non-UPS outlet. So when the power does go out, it's sort of like an early warning and lets people know something's up. Just say.
Good. It looks like that one lays against the wall when you plug it in so that when the power goes out, it's already shining light. It's flooding the wall with light.
That is correct.
Yeah.
Yep.
Wow.
It came in handy twice when we lost power here at the studios and the generators went online with no problem. But I got a phone call saying, I think we're on generator, and I saw the lights in the hallway go on at the outlets. I'm like, yep, that's the way it works.
I might call those removable wall sconces that work when the power's out.
Yes, exactly.
Cool. All right. Yeah. I like that. Where'd you get that?
These are Coleman brand. I think we bought them at a local hardware store, believe it or not, some time ago. These are coming up on 2 years old. And believe it or not, they do have replaceable batteries in them. There's two. I forgot the model number, but you can replace it.
Huh. That's cool. It seems unusual, but good. Good. All right. Don Mussel. With years and years of Hawaii experience, mountaintop, what you got for us?
Oh, I don't know. What are you looking for?
a tip of the week that maybe you can leave our listeners with. What's advice? What do you carry with you to the transmitter side? Because you said if you're miles and an hour or more from civilization, you carry first aid with you. I mean, what's important when you're up like places like that?
Well, besides the fact that Hawaii Public Radio believes in having tools at every different site, so we don't have to carry them. But at each site, yes, we have first aid kits, which we have to replace every year. And when I say we, it's me, because I'm the one who does all that stuff. And it's come in handy. I make mistakes. I fall down. I scratch. Poke a hole in my hand or something like that. So it's good to have the first aid kit. You really, especially if you're going to a remote site away from town, I wouldn't go without it.
Do you have a preference as to lock access to a site? I guess a lot of your sites are multi-user, but how do you take care of shared access into a secured building?
Well, the buildings actually are just going to have keys. We're going to have to give them to people who work up there, and it's their responsibility to hang on to them and not lose them. Locks wear out, so you got to be prepared to replace them. And most of the remote sites have pretty serious locks on them. Access-wise to gates and that kind of thing, we'll put combo locks in. And I don't want to share all my secrets, but you know, I'm like anybody else. I can't remember combos. So what do you do? If you got more than one station at the tower, it's easy. Just pick one station and use the frequency.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to tell you which station.
Well, we'll try 100.1 and 100.2 and 100.3. Well, I guess if it's a frequency in the U.S., it's going to be an odd number and an odd killers. All right. Yeah. Well, I do like your idea of putting toolboxes at transmitter sites. I didn't used to do that. And my business partner, Larry Fuss, insisted on putting at least, you know, a modicum of basic tools. So we go buy cheap toolboxes from Big Lots or somewhere and put just basic hand tools in there and a voltmeter, you know, a $5 Chinese voltmeter. And so, yeah, if I forget the tools or can't bring them up the hill or whatever, then I can get, you know, probably 80% of whatever would need to be done.
Yeah. And don't forget the soldering iron and solder.
You know, I had – this is a good topic, and I'll take one more sec to mention that. I had to replace a pallet, an RF module on a Nautel transmitter. And I just had my wimpy little 25-watt soldering pencil with me, and that wasn't going to cut it for the big landing pads and big wires. And there were only a three or four or five wires on this pallet, but they had to – so what did I do? Well, I thought, how can I – and I thought, let's see what Walmart has. If I have to buy a big soldering pistol, okay. But let's, and you know what they had? Walmart had a butane torch, a little butane torch. And I don't know, it may have been $13 and a bottle of butane. And I mean, just a little, you know, little can of butane. And voila, it worked great. It was fabulous. I got that thing swapped out in a few minutes, and now I've got a butane torch.
That's once again, the Hawaiian word for that is akamai, which means smart. When you've got to go to a mountaintop on a helicopter and it's $500 each way, the last thing you want to think of when you get to the mountain is, oh, I forgot to bring whatever. That's an expensive mistake. So better to have it there.
Yeah. Getting to the transmitter site in Mound Bayou, Mississippi is not as expensive as with a helicopter. Wow. Hey, Don, thank you so much for joining us from Hawaii. I'm sorry you've had all that rain. I saw in the news where one of your villages there broke some record for rain out in a 24-hour period, 46, 7, 8 inches in 24 hours.
48 inches. It's about 6 miles west of me. Yeah.
Wow.
The little town of Hanalei. Yeah,
but you've also got a mountaintop there. You've also got a mountaintop there on Kauai that sometimes, some years, gets more rainfall than any other place on the planet.
Well, the average rainfall up there is 450 inches a year.
Jeez.
And the most we've ever seen since I've been here was in 1997. We got 760 inches up there. How many feet is that?
Yeah, how
many to measure?
Divide. You said how many? 700?
760 inches.
760 divided by 12 inches. Come on, I can't even do that. And of course, I should in my head. Why can't I do this in my head? Because I've got to calculate it. 63 feet of rain.
Spread out over the year, but yes, we have seasons here too, and we have the wet season right now. So, and it all flows downhill, so it all goes in the ocean. But you know, it gets things out of the way on the way there. So, it's not, as we say around here, it's not the mainland.
Well, 63 feet of rain in a year—that's only 2 inches of rain a day. So that seems much more manageable, doesn't it?
Wow. There you go. See?
Chris Tobin, hey, thank you for being with us from the Performance Studio and now performing nightly here. Order the beef tips. They're great.
Thanks. Thanks, Don, for coming on. It's been great. Those pictures are awesome.
Oh, sure.
Going through your albums, it was pretty cool. And I can at least appreciate some of the climbing ones that I've done, that I do climbing too. So I can appreciate what it's like.
It has its moments, that's for sure.
That it does.
So Don Musselman in Hawaii and Chris Tobin in New Jersey. And next week, our guest is Peter Femal of Public Media Engineering. And I've met Peter once. Great guy, smart engineer. We're going to learn a lot from Peter as well. So I want to thank you again, both of you, for being on the show. Don, thanks for taking time out of your day to join us from Hawaii. And Chris, thank you for joining us too at the end of your day. Hey, I got to thank Suncast too for getting all those pictures lined up and taking care of our video switching and lower third needs here on This Week in Radio Tech. Hey, we got to go. Thanks to all the sponsors. Be sure you visit them. It really helps us out if you say something nice about the show to our sponsors. So thanks a lot. You can check out the website anytime at thisweekinradiotech.com. You'll find an archive of almost all the old shows there. So you can search for a keyword, find something you want to learn about, search for one of the engineering celebrities that you may know, and you'll find it right there at thisweekinradiotech.com. Thanks again, Suncast, and also Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.